Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted, and I really mean that, to be in conversation today with Tim McClellan, partner and owner with Walter McTeague of McTeague & McClellan, jewelers in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. You can find out more at mc2jewels.com. Emphasizing groundbreaking design, exceptional gemstones, and superior craftsmanship, the MC2 collaboration blends Walter McTeague's diamond and gemstone expertise with the creativity of his friend, the artist and master jeweler, Tim McClellan. Tim grew up in a family of artists and began his own aesthetic pursuits at an early age. His love and fascination for working with metals began in high school art class and developed further while attending the program in artistry at Boston University. At a time when traditional jewel-making techniques were dying out, Tim had an opportunity to apprentice with a European master jeweler who insisted that he learn the old world methods. Through this training, Tim developed a foundation of knowledge and skill in traditional jewelry making, which, augmented with formal studies in the fine arts and art history, would allow him to eventually forge his own path in the jewelry world. Tim developed a reputation for skill and did fine restoration work for museums and auction houses on antique jewelry, including pieces by the best jewelry makers of the 19th century and early 20th century. The work taught, challenged, and inspired him to work at the highest level. But Tim is an artist, and his passion lay in experimenting and developing his own style and creating his own design, which led to his eventual partnership with Walter. We'll talk with Tim McClellan about all of this and much more. But first, welcome Tim McClellan.
Thanks.
Well, Tim, first of all, welcome to the program. Second of all, I have to tell the truth. You guys were very nice. You invited me into your beautiful, beautiful headquarters in downtown Great Barrington, which had been restored to the T's. Was it once a church?
Yes, it was a Christian Science church.
That's what I thought. You know, I didn't really want to go, I'll be honest with you. I just didn't want to go. I said, who needs this? Who wants this? I don't want to do this. But I brought the always wonderful Roselle with me, who is an appreciator of the arts. And we walked in and our eyes popped out of our heads. We couldn't believe what we saw and I couldn't get enough of it. And frankly, Tim, I said, well, I got to get him here because I want everybody in the audience to know what he's done because it's extraordinary. So tell us about how you got started in that first art class. What were you doing there?
Well, I was in Michigan in the early 70s, and they had a jewelry making program in our public high school, which I had no way of knowing was unique, but they did offer this. And as a sophomore in high school, I took a class and immediately knew that that was going to be my calling.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you go home and tell your parents?
No, but there was something about seeing, they were melting metal in a crucible, and I saw this bright liquid metal. We were melting silver quarters. I guess you're not supposed to do that, but we were melting these quarters to make into something else, and I knew that that was going to be where it was for me.
Right. How complicated did you think it was going to make your life? I mean, there are, some kids will go home and say, I want to be a jewelry maker, and Papa and Mama will say, no, we want you to be a lawyer.
Well, you know, my family was accepting. I think they were sort of relieved that I found some sort of focus, honestly. And it was something that I could do in the margins. I didn't have to make it a full career at that point. And it was just very interesting. And there were a few other students who were doing it. And it was nice to be good at something.
But when you're done with the class, you kept going.
What's that?
When you were done with the class, you kept going.
Oh, yes. In fact, I started taking some night classes. Cranbrook was nearby, Cranbrook Academy, and they had some night classes in jewelry. So I immediately started expanding that.
Okay. So take us from there. Did you go to college?
I was not a great student in high school, but I was encouraged to go to a place called Haystack, which is in Maine, on the coast of Maine in Deer Isle. And that is an artist community, a craft community, which I went to right out of high school and spent the summer there and learned from some very sophisticated people, European designers of jewelry. I was way in over my head, but it really continued my appreciation for the whole thing. And I then ended up going to Boston University immediately, which I hadn't even applied to, but I scrambled around and found that they had, Boston University had started what they called the Program in Artisanry, and it was the first year of this program.
Not there anymore, is it?
It's not there anymore. It was only there for about 10 years.
You got lucky.
I got very lucky because it was a real coming together of a lot of talented craftspeople around the country. And I was in on the beginning of that, and it was really a real special time in the mid-70s there.
So now classical education, you know, college education, here I was a college teacher for 40 years or something, and but the way it was done in the old country, the Europeans you were working with and others, was apprenticeship, wasn't it?
Yes, and that was a big difference between the art school approach to making jewelry in the 70s, which was pretty much anything you could think of was legitimate to make. And the idea that you have this apprenticeship thing, which was the old European method, which was still alive. There were still enough of the old European masters that were still alive. Particularly, there were some in Boston. And I got lucky enough to work and apprentice and go to school while I was in Boston University. So I got a lot of, I got both ends of the spectrum.
How did the old guys treat you?
They treated me terribly. They were rude. One guy spit.
Spit at you?
He didn't spit at me. He spit near me. And
give us the context. He takes a look at something you've done, and he goes, is
yes.
that what happened?
Yeah, and he would make faces and scorn us, and it really felt like being in an old world sweatshop. And the boss was okay, but he didn't pay well. The good thing about it was that if you got through that in one piece, you knew that you were going to be a jeweler. It was no question that if you could tolerate that.
We're talking to Tim McClellan. He's a master jeweler, and I'm just fascinated by what I've seen of his work, and I've seen what he's done in downtown Great Barrington. It's an incredible thing that you've done there. Okay, so let's move ahead. You're there. Do you take any interest in other things like women?
Well, you know, in art school and everything like that, that's, you know, it's one of those things that is unavoidable. And my wife happened to be going to the program in artisanry, so we've been together for 37 years, and
pretty good.
She's also a metalsmith. We referred to it as metalsmithing. We weren't jewelers because metalsmithing is more broad. It involves all the different metals, which I'm very interested in, and my wife is too. She's a silversmith and designs flatware and tableware for industry.
I saw her at your studio in full uniform. She had the thing over her face, and you know, she was very serious and doing that. And your relationship all these years has not suffered that one of you is condescending towards the other?
It has suffered that, but you never can tell who's going to be condescending to who.
Which way? Okay, so you take us on the journey. What happens next?
Well, you know, I guess I considered myself a silversmith when I got out of school. And so, but it's very, very difficult to make a living as a silversmith. It just takes too much time to make each piece, hundreds of hours sometimes for something that, you know, these days people are less interested in silver as of something. It's hard to keep up. You have to polish it and keep it. It's just less often purchased by people. So I knew how to use metal, so I moved down to New York with my future wife, and I started being a freelance jeweler.
Now, what did you look like in those days? Were you sort of a hippie?
I was shabby.
You were shabby.
Yeah.
Now,
you cleaned
up pretty well now.
Well, I had my grandfather's overcoat. I remember I inherited this thing, and as a freelancer, when I went up to the jeweler's district to try and get work and ply my
trade. Like in the
40s
in New York City?
Yeah, yes. Around 47th Street, yeah. Up around there. I would wear this overcoat, and I was not as self-aware as I might have been, but I didn't get a great reception. But eventually people did see that I had some skill and started giving me work. But
do you remember the breakthrough?
Yeah, there was a jeweler that I had worked for in Boston for a little while, and I got an introduction into the premier jeweler, you know, behind-the-scene jeweler of that time. He was a very prominent gem dealer and antique jewelry buyer and seller.
Does he have a name?
Yeah, his name was Jack Ortman.
Okay.
And he was very old school himself, quite an elderly gentleman, and a tough guy. He was a tough dealer of jewelry. But
what do you mean tough?
He had a reputation for being very shrewd, very kind of, I don't know how to characterize it.
Argumentative, maybe, or?
Gruff. Tough.
Can you imitate him?
Yes. He would call me at 5 o'clock in the morning, and he would have a piece that he wanted me to work on. And I would pick the phone up way earlier than I like to get up, and I would hear this voice on the other end of the phone, and it would say, Jack Ortman. And that was enough to, like, wake you up, and, you know, and he would call me to the office in Midtown and give me some work.
Now, I want to go back a little bit. Do you remember your interview with him when you first met him that led to your being accepted?
He was very businesslike. He just handed people work, and then you got more work based on the merit of how well you did.
Interesting. Did you have to work not only good but fast?
Yes, and I learned so much so fast. And there's a trick of being a freelance jeweler, which is that you never ever say that you can't do something.
Uh-huh.
You always can do it, yeah. And so I would say yes before I even looked at what he was handing me. And you get very skilled at figuring out how to.
But he never spit at you, did he? No.
No, he was not that type.
Was he ever abusive to you?
No, not really. But he was on a level that I was not, even as a pretty good jeweler, I wasn't really. You know, I wasn't much of a...
But he could actually do the work himself.
Oh, no. He was a dealer.
Yeah.
He was a dealer. He had to rely on people like me.
Yeah, so...
But the interesting thing, too, is that in his office is where I met Walter McTeague, my partner.
Uh-huh. Tell us about that.
Well,
how did that happen?
We were both young, which right then and there was one of those things that you didn't see too often in that trade. People were much more seasoned than we were, and we were a little scruffy. Walter was a little more polished than me.
Were you guys smoking dope back in those days?
We weren't. No, we weren't
okay.
Smoking dope.
Okay.
We had smoked dope probably earlier, but
yeah.
It was not really the thing at that point. And I remember seeing this guy, and he was young, and he was Irish looking. And I thought, what is he doing in this office? And I think he was sort of looking at me the same way. And we walked out of the office, and Walter had been buying and selling to Jack Ortman, and which was in itself kind of a feat because, like I say, Jack Ortman was a tough buyer, tough seller. So we got out of his office. We kind of went out together and got in the elevator, and we were both wearing some kind of scruffy shoes, as I remember. And I said, I kind of made a comment about that. I said, where do you shop for your shoes? And anyway, we struck up a conversation, and we were friends by the time the elevator got to the first
floor.
And
that's lasted for all of these years.
Yeah, that was 1985.
Right. It's tough to be partners, right? Because at some point, you know, at the end of every band, there's a band fight, and at the end of every partner, there's a partner fight.
You know, that's often true, and I will say that one of the reasons that we started our partnership was just because we liked each other so much, which is true. It's you start out with great intentions, and it is like a marriage in a way.
So how did you start the partnership? When was it decided? We now have you maybe having a cup of coffee together with your scruffy shoes, but at what point did you decide, okay, it's time to be partners?
Well, we did have those coffee and lunch conversations, and we would dream up and scheme up what a partnership would look like. And we thought of maybe starting a store or some sort of a shop in New York City. We decided against that. And, you know, it's a little over our heads at that point. But Walter got a job at Harry Winston and became the director of purchasing at Harry Winston. He had the credentials to do that. And he
now understood. His father was an artist too, right?
His father was a jeweler.
Jeweler.
And his grandfather and great-grandfather. So they came from a long line of diamond and jewelry dealers.
Did he actually know Harry Winston, or was Harry Winston gone by that time?
I imagine that his father knew Harry Winston, yeah. But Walter didn't know him. Yes. He knew his...
That's a huge job that he had there.
He had a huge job, and he got involved in that, and it happened to be not Walter, my friend Walter's cup of tea. It was too corporate, a little bit too hard-edged, and anybody that knows Walter knows that he's a very easygoing...
Sweet guy.
He's a sweet guy, and he didn't like it. This is another funny story. He had a moment when he realized that this was not for him, and he got out of New York. He had two young kids, and he decided he was going to try something entirely different, which was to move up to the country and start a dairy farm, which he did. He moved to Hillsdale, New York.
In Columbia County, right outside of the Berkshires.
Yeah. With two young, almost infants, and bought 40 cows and started milking cows. And he lasted, I think, a hot 3 months doing that.
Now, what years were those?
That was about 1990.
See, to me, 1990 was yesterday, but that's because I'm so much older than you are. But okay, 1990, go ahead.
And then by the time he realized that dairy farming was not going to be his real successful career for him, he...
You've been visiting him, Mario, has
yes,
to interrupt.
Yes.
But you went up to Hillsdale
yeah.
to visit him.
And, yeah, we were friends and we would visit and, you know, it would come up. It was, I didn't know where Hillsdale was from New
sure.
York City. It was just somewhere north. And he realized that the jewelry business was not so bad. Let me just put it that way.
It wasn't as bad as milking cows at right. 3 o'clock in the morning.
Exactly. So he started looking around, and then he started asking me if I would consider moving up there to start a business. And it was.
And
just,
what were you doing at that moment? At that moment, you were still working for the Gruff Guy?
I wasn't. I was working as a freelancer for all different types of places. Auction houses would get me to restore pieces. I got pretty good at restoring important pieces of metalwork and, you know, objet and jewelry of all kinds. But there was a definite ceiling on that.
But you, but let me just stop you for a moment and say it's clear to McClellan that you had a gene. You know, I mean, I could try to make jewelry for the rest of my life. I wouldn't be able to do it or to play, you know, a great trumpet. I do play trumpet, but it's always been limited, or banjo. But there is a gene, isn't there? There's an art gene.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, I feel very fortunate that I can do this. It seems like if I couldn't, I would be really wondering what I would do.
Interesting, because I keep meeting people who can't but think they can. Not only jewelers, but in virtually every undertaking.
Well, it's been good to have the experience of starting a partnership and having a broader business, because you are forced to do things that you're not really great at, and maybe even speaking on the radio is something that...
Oh, you're very good on the radio. Very good.
But anyway... You know, you're called on to do other things, and I think that informs what you're really good at.
Okay, so now you go up, you visit him in Hillsdale. He says you want to be a partner, start a business up here, and you say?
Well, right off the bat, it sort of goes back to what you were talking about before. Walter became a very, very close, good friend, and I didn't want to...
Have a band fight.
I didn't want to have a band fight. I didn't want to... have a business partnership that interrupted our friendship. So we sort of...
Is that really true?
It is true.
Okay.
It is true. And we sort of made a pact. It was a little bit odd, I guess, but we tried to do that. Now, that has been challenged many, many times over the years. But I will say that to this day, Walter McTeague is a tremendous friend and a really good guy. And we socialize together and we kid each other and love each other.
So give us a little bit more of the... You didn't tell us what the agreement was. You made a pact. But what was the pact?
The pact was that we wouldn't let the business interrupt our friendship. If the business got to the point that it wasn't going to... Our friendship was going to be too challenged by it, that we would abandon the business.
But several times you said it's been challenged.
Oh, of course, of course.
You mean there were times you just didn't agree?
Oh, well, you know, when you're thrown together day in and day out for years, we've traveled together, we've been all over the world together. You know, we're both certainly somewhat ambitious, but your approach can be quite different about that.
So let's go back to that moment when he asks you to be partners and you say yes. Then you had to find a place, right? You had to decide what you were going to do and where you were going to do it. How'd you do that?
Well, we knew that we wanted to be in Great Barrington. We felt that Great Barrington was a kind of a little bit of a sleeper, that there was nothing like us there and that we could start very small and not have to have any a huge amount of overhead. We had no capital. We had zero capital. We had no inventory. We had nothing.
Well, you guys had been both working, making productive, doing a productive living. You were very good at your job. He had worked for Harry Winston, for God's sakes. So there had to be some money.
There was no money.
And neither of you married well enough to have money?
Not a chance. The coffers were empty, but we had a good reputation. Walter had a good reputation in the business, so we were able to open the doors at 597 South Main Street.
For those of you who don't know where it is, down by the Guidos.
Yes, and it was a little tiny yellow building that we painted yellow, and we were able to move in there, and we borrowed estate jewelry, antique jewelry from other dealers to show because we had none of our own. And we started doing everything. We started making pieces, special pieces for people when they came in. What would you like us to make you? Would you like some wedding bands? Of course, we'll do anything. And we scrambled and...
Could you tell when a high roller came into the store? In other words, this is going to be potentially a good customer.
In the Berkshires, it's very hard to tell that because people keep such a low profile. They're not dressed up. They don't put on airs. It's actually a really nice place to do business because it's far more relaxed than the city, and people are not in as much of a hurry. And it kind of doesn't matter. The people that have come to us over the years are people that really love jewelry, and they, I guess, can sort of sense that we do too. So there's a kind of automatic dialogue that starts when people, even you, Alan, seem to enjoy yourself when you came in.
I did. And I was brought in, you know, literally by the hair, kicking and screaming. I don't want to do this, but I did it, and I was fascinated because we're going there. But you've created something that's much bigger than what you've described up until now. So now you have this little place, and Christmas, it was so little that on Christmas time, you put a big red bow around this yellow building of yours, and you could do that easily because it was that small.
Yes. Yeah. We put a big bow and a ribbon around the building and became a little bit of a landmark to see that at Christmas time.
It did indeed. And you had the rarest of all things. You had some parking in front of your place so that people could stop and shop and do all of that. Okay, so now we're going on to the next phase. How long did you do that little yellow house stuff?
We were in that place for about 16 or 17 years.
It's a long time.
It was a long time, and it was just Walter and myself, and then we added people, and by the time we moved out a couple years ago, we had a staff of 9 people in that
time. In that little place?
Yeah.
Wow.
Including 3 other jewelers making jewelry.
Were they working for you or were they working with you?
No, they were working for us, but in the space that small, everything's a collaboration.
Right.
You know, so we got very used to working with one another's strengths.
We were talking with Tim McClelland of McTeague and McClelland, a jeweler, a master, silversmith, metalsmith, and jeweler. And we're very pleased to have you with us because I find the whole thing so exciting. Okay, so you're there 16 years. Now you have 9 people working for you or working in the building. I guess it's 7 and 2, right? I mean, there were 2 of you and 7 more, so that's 9. Okay, and at what point do you say, you know, we're bursting out of here?
Well, we had been bursting out for a long time, and it so happened that down a little closer to the village of Great Barrington, the beautiful old building came available. Actually, I approached the Christian Science Church about purchasing their building because it
You knew that they were going to leave.
Well, it seemed like the building was kind of in a little bit of a state of disrepair. It seemed like it needed some TLC.
Right.
And so we just took a chance and asked if they would be willing to sell it to us. And they were.
Were there any conditions? Could you never see a doctor again for the rest of your life?
No, but, you know, we did make the offer that we would honor the building. And they were very attached to the building. They'd had it for almost 100 years.
Wow.
And so we promised that we would do justice to it and really make it beautiful again. And that was enough for them, and they were very gracious sellers.
Did you get a good deal?
We got a good deal, but we also did put a huge amount of money into it.
Well, that is clear. That's clear. So now you and your partner have decided that you are going to go to this new place. Was that transition very tough on you?
Surprisingly not. We had been through enough up to that point where we were very excited. And
did you have some money by this time?
We had enough to just barely do it the way that we wanted to do it.
Did you have to take a mortgage?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
No doubt.
No, okay. You join the rest of us. Yep. Okay, then what happened?
Well, we had driven past that place 100 times, 1,000 times over the years. And we always felt like it was going to be the perfect place to have the kind of destination that we envisioned. That would be a real high vision for what we could do.
So you say destination rather than, you know, street shopping.
Yes.
Because it's at the end of Great Barrington, yes, in a little town. But it really, you'd have to make a decision to go there.
Yes. And that was always the kind of people that like us and appreciate us. It's always been that way. Mm-hmm. It's always been people that wanted to go a little bit out of their way to see something out of the ordinary.
Okay, so you make the thing, you buy the building. What do you do with it? I mean, how do you decide? Because it's an extraordinary job you've done with it. I'm going to just advance the story that much and say, you know, you're in a museum. And how did you decide what to do? Did you have to hire an architect? Who did all of that for you?
We did, just Walter and I did it. We consulted with people, but we've always wanted to do things our way. We're kind of stubborn in that way, and we planned a lot, and we knew that we needed to have a really beautiful workshop for the jewelers to work in. That was really the main thing. It wasn't to have a showroom or a gallery so much as having really great facility for the making of jewelry. It's so uncommon to have a beautiful workshop for jewelry. They're usually kind of depressing places, honestly. And we wanted a bright, beautiful workshop and really fitted to excel. And we got that. And we do tour. People are able to come up and see the workshop, and we're very proud of it. And we have tremendous jewelers, the best jewelers in the world. I would put any of our 4 jewelers up against any jewelers.
How'd you get them? Who are they? Where they come from?
My right-hand man, I went to school with at BU. He's been a jeweler all that time, and we plucked him out of Boston, where he'd been a freelancer. And lucky to have him. We're very close and have worked together for many projects. And
what's his name?
His name is Steve Heyer.
Okay.
And he's a wonderful guy, member of the Sheffield Fire Department, just sweetest guy you'll ever meet. And her name is Barbara Crocker, and she was a local, and she had been working around, and she has the patience of Job. She can do anything very carefully and patiently and with the most care. And I'm very, very fortunate to work with these people. These are really special artists. And we have another gentleman that's come to us from St. Petersburg, and he is a tremendous craftsperson. It's really true. They could work at any jewelry and sit in the top seat of any jewelry store workshop in the world. So
that's 3. You got one more to go.
We have a new person from Brooklyn, and she worked at a job shop similar to, you know, what I used to do down in when I was in Boston, that made a lot of jewelry for Harry Winston and Cartier. And she was the top jeweler there. Very unusual to have a young woman who has that kind of skill that young. She was the only woman in the whole shop. It's very typical to not have a lot of women in jewelry shops. They tend to be, you know, kind of chauvinistic places, and has been over the years. So, you know, they have to double earn their merits in a place like that. You know, we're not a huge operation where we, you know, make a lot of volume pieces. We make pieces slowly. It's a little like a restaurant that does, you know, farm to table. We make each piece very, very carefully, and often with all the jewelers are involved in one piece of jewelry.
Really?
Yeah. So
you have conferences? I mean,
yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Yep. We have conferences almost, you know, every week. We talk about what's being made, who's the most adept at making a certain aspect of it, who can show the other person what they're doing. And jewelry is very specialized, but we tend to be more general than most jewelry companies.
What's the most expensive thing in your shop right now?
You know, you'd have to ask Walter that. I kind of don't pay so much attention to that part of it.
Well, but have you sold pieces that are in excess of $100,000 or $200,000?
Oh, yeah, we have. Sure.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I just want to give people an idea of what the upper end is.
Yeah.
So is the upper end $1 million?
Not really, no, but I would say that's a threshold that's not a good.
So, okay, I hear you're a gentleman in so many senses, and you don't want to get into my crass commercialism. But let's just put it this way. If somebody is asking you to do something for them, and your stuff has been in magazines and other things, if they're asking you to do something for them, in some cases, they have a lot of money and the sky's the limit, right?
Well, yeah, and that definitely is situations. So, for instance, I had a client who wanted a very special rosary made.
Yeah, I've seen a picture of that. It's great.
And he wanted something very special. He's a very devout Catholic, and he wanted something that he could carry with him in his pocket. So I made him what's called a 10-decade rosary. It's not a full-length one that you wear around your neck.
Is a rosary a cross?
Yeah, it's a cross.
Yeah.
Yeah, with beads, rosary beads. So I made this piece. It's all platinum. It has gemstones. It took me about 6 months to make it, maybe more than that.
Working almost full time on this?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And enlisting the help of the other jewelers to a degree.
How did you negotiate the concept? He came to you and said, I'd like you to do this. How'd you meet him?
He walked right in the store. He walked right in our showroom. Very sophisticated guy, and somebody that could shop at any place in the world and probably has. And I guess he recognized that I was collaborative. And our customers definitely have their own people, their own ideas about what's beautiful. And we are a collaborative place.
Did he check in during those 6 months with you as to how it was coming?
Oh, sure.
Did he have any ideas in terms of...
No, but we got the idea. He's a wonderful guy and somebody that really knows how to allow an artist to work in their own way, brings the best out in somebody. It was a very successful piece, and we were very proud of it.
How would you have known it was successful? He looked at it and said, this is excellent, or you knew it was excellent?
I think it was the consensus that it had all the elements that go into making a beautiful piece.
So what was in it?
It was platinum and gold and sapphires and tooled metalwork. There was an inscription on the inside, quite a long poem, prayer that was inscribed on the inside.
How'd you get that done?
That was done by a tremendous engraver. Like I was saying, jewelry can be quite specialized, sure. And certain people only do certain processes and make that their whole career, their whole life. And there's an engraver in New York, the king of engraving, only works for a very few people, and I'm one of them, luckily. And he was able to inscribe the prayer, it's called the Magnificat, on the inside of this thing. It's a little bit larger than a large postage stamp. So he was able to inscribe quite a long prayer and onto the platinum in beautiful script. And it was quite a feat. I mean, it's really done in the way that something would have been done by a master in medieval times. There's no difference. It's all done perfectly. And, you know, like it would have been done by Fabergé or somebody like that.
So let me get this straight. Now you're putting platinum and gold and diamonds all into a piece, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now you have to front all of that, right? I mean, you're buying a lot of material and it's costing a lot of money to do that. Does he have to pay up to get the stuff, or do you do it and then take the chance that he's going to like it at the end?
No, I think there's a process that we have where people put a deposit down. They approve the design, and we're definitely have done a lot of this commission work, special commission work. And so...
Have you ever been left standing high and dry?
No. Uh-huh. You know, we do, I would say, maybe a third of the work that we do is special commission work. And a third of it is, or maybe two-thirds of it, would be the pieces that we make for our own, you know, our own inventory, our own, just because we love it.
Do you remember the day that Mr. X came in, saw the piece that you had made for him, and took his first really good look at the completed project?
Yes, I do.
Tell us about it.
Well, we had a special box made for it in Italy. It was a very important piece. I mean, it was an expensive piece of jewelry. And we had
a box. Can we say over $100,000?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so we had a box made and put, you know, I actually went to his house to present it to him. And he was just very, very pleased. He's a very good artistic eye, and I could tell that it was right on the money. And it was very gratifying, you know. He's become a good friend. And
so somewhere in this world, there's a guy walking around with at least, because I think it's at least, a $100,000 rosary in his pocket. He doesn't want to get mugged, that's for sure.
Well, actually, he did get mugged.
No.
In New York City, but they didn't take that.
They didn't have any taste?
Passport and everything else. But I will say that that rosary has been blessed by two popes now. So it's a significant piece. Now, I want to stop for a second, because you're asking about all the money and stuff like that, but I want to stop for a second. The tradition of fine jewelry is much higher, on a higher artistic level, than what normally is thought of these days. In other words, jewelry is very much associated nowadays with commerce and money. And it is very annoying to those of us who make jewelry, because we consider it to be one of the most wonderful decorative arts. And if I was doing this for the money, I would be down in New York City and trying to punch my way through that crowd. But I'm doing it up in Great Barrington because we have the freedom to not be influenced by all that stuff. And it's really, I mean, if you look at the tradition of fine jewelry throughout the ages, and you go to the museums and you see the museum exhibitions that are very, very popular. People throng to the Metropolitan to see a show on Greek.
Indeed, they do.
Greek Hellenistic gold. Those are the most popular shows. Those are popular for a reason. It's because the artistry that has gone into the jewelry, that those pieces that were made, you know, 2,000 years ago, it still holds up. It's still beautiful. It's still incredible. It's a part of the human story. And, you know, we had a show of beads, ancient beads, about a year ago.
I mean, in your gallery?
In our gallery. Yeah. That some of them were 5,000 years old, some are older. And the history of human adornment goes back almost 100,000 years. It's way predates any kind of records of any kind, but people were adorning themselves with jewelry ever since humans had any kind of culture whatsoever. And it's still happening. We're still part of that, no matter how modern.
Well, are you unique? In other words, look, you know, I'm sorry for the grotesqueness of trying to figure out how much everything costs. I do think it's something that people are interested in. But are you unique? I mean, you clearly are an artist, and I've seen it for myself, and so is Roselle. But the question is, there are also jewelry shops all around the place, you know, which are hawking jewels.
Yes, and most of the jewelry nowadays, so much jewelry is made mechanically. It's made on computer design. You know, CAD is a big design tool now. It's made in the Far East, in China and Thailand. The tradition of fine jewelry is diminishing, at least in terms of the way that pieces are made and the care and the quality and all that kind of stuff. It's become very commoditized. There's a huge amount of corporate level of jewelry. Even the big name jewelers these days are in, you know, every airport, they're in every city. It's a franchise. And what is getting lost is the personal touch, which is the whole thing of jewelry. That's the whole deal. People wear jewelry. You're wearing a wedding ring right on
$8
your finger.
$8, McDougal Street.
See?
Silver.
Okay, so that's good. I probably work for the person on McDougal Street. But there's something very personal about it. And people are always going to want that personal aspect of it. It means something to them. And we always say, you know, whether it's better to have one or two pieces of jewelry that are really suit you and are beautifully made than have a whole jewelry box full of stuff. I totally think that's true. And it doesn't even have to be terribly expensive. And we sell pieces that aren't hugely expensive. But everything we try and do has a heart to it. It has some sort of care and quality, you know, and it is becoming more and more unique these days. I will say it. I don't know if we're 100% unique, but people do find us and come to us from all over the world because we're doing something that is becoming more and more rare.
We're in conversation today with Tim McClelland, partner and owner with Walter McTeague of McTeague and McClelland, a jeweler in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, but not just any jeweler, as you are hearing. You can find out more at mc2jewels.com. So, Tim McClelland, one of the questions I get asked a lot is, when you die, who will take over for you? Have you thought about your legacy at all?
Well, I have a daughter who is in the fashion department at Pratt in Brooklyn right now, who's very interested in fashion and style, and she was advised by one of her professors to take a jewelry course because she had been talking about her family and all that. So that's one thing. And Walter has a son who's Walter IV, who has also been working in the trade in New York. So I guess it does get passed on if you have the, you know, you never can tell. But
if somebody wants to schedule a tour of your facility, and it is so beautiful, it's at the south end of Great Barrington, right on the corner of Route 23 and Route 7. How do they get to come and see what we saw?
They can just show up. Usually we're there 10 to 5. Tuesday through Saturday. You know, it's like you mentioned before, we're not on the sidewalk. There's not a lot of people in there all the time. So we're usually working, making things, happy to show people around. Walter and Samantha is the gemologist that we have working for us. Very frequently people bring in their jewelry to have it looked at to see what they have.
So you do give people estimates on what their jewelry is worth?
Oh, definitely. And we
do they have to pay for that?
No.
Is that right? So they just come in and plump down grandma's tiara?
We do it every day.
Really?
Every day people come in and we're interested ourselves. We really know what we're looking at.
What Walter, if you're wrong?
No, we're not wrong. No, so, no, we...
Do you ever see anybody's knees buckle like on Antique Roadshow when you say, this piece is very rare, it's worth a couple hundred thousand dollars?
Yes, people do have that.
Do they faint?
Nobody's fainted.
Yeah.
But people will bring a whole box of stuff in and we'll go through every piece with them and tell them what it is, what the value is, if it's worth keeping, if they should sell it, where are their options for selling it, if they should put it in the auction, if they should try and just sell it for the scrap metal. You know, there's a lot of options that people have, and Walter is very, very good at that. He's a buyer and a dealer of estate jewelry. That's his great gift. And he's a Boy Scout. He's a good guy, and he really helps people with this stuff. And Samantha, the two of them are quite amazing.
Now, I noticed that you also put on shows. When we were at your place, you were doing a show of boxes, really unique boxes, stuff that you couldn't see anywhere. How's it decided when and how you'll do these shows that you do.
Well, with the new space that we are in, we obviously had a lot more space, and part of it we designated as being exhibition space. So as we kind of feel like it, we think up and dream up interesting exhibits to have there. And it's good because it fits with the sort of cultural part of the Berkshires. There's a lot of interesting things going on in the Berkshires all summer and throughout the year. And we're part of that now. We don't do it as a regular thing, but we will put together an interesting show. So the one that you mentioned is to do with jewelry boxes, which were made by some of the premier American furniture makers who made these small little chests specifically for the show. It was an invitational show, and we had really beautiful pieces made. One of the participants was the president of Rhode Island School of Design, Roseanne Summerson, and she's a master furniture maker. She developed the furniture department at RISD, and she's a friend from back in the days when we all went to school together. She didn't go to BU, but she was part of that crowd. And so it was a real wonderful show. And like I said, we had the one with the beads before. We've had ones, you know, we're cooking up. We just enjoy doing it.
Do you ever have famous people come into the store, really famous?
Oh, sure. I bet you want to know who they are.
Well, I do. But I can only imagine, because the Berkshires, of course, are filled with fabulous.
We have the jeweler's code of silence.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
So if I asked you if Yo-Yo Ma had ever come into your store, you wouldn't say yes or no.
I wouldn't say yes or no, but I would say that he's such a nice guy.
He's the best.
Yeah, he is the best.
And what does the fact that there is so much other culture in the Berkshires, like the Boston Symphony, like Yo-Yo Ma, like Jacob's Pillow, what does that mean to you as a business?
Oh, well, like I mentioned before, when we first dreamt of having an important jewelry establishment in the Berkshires, we were advised against it. Walter's father told us we were crazy.
Walter the second.
Walter Jr. So he told us we were crazy because he thought that between being in New England and being in a place where people weren't showy and people weren't dressed up and weren't going to the opera and all that stuff, that we were just out of our
minds. They go to the opera
now,
but that's different.
Right. But it's turned out to be really a wonderful place, particularly because of the culture. People come up here and are very, very sophisticated. They really know what they're doing, you know, in the world of culture and music and theater and art. And, you know, we're just very grateful to be a part of that. It's a small community, as you know.
It is, but it's also getting gussied up. We're getting into a stage now where Great Barrington ain't what it used to be. It's getting to be a little bit more upscale. We know that because of what homes are going for and other things that are happening. Has that affected you?
Not really. I mean,
do you agree with my assessment that it's getting gussied up?
I still think that people come here to be low-key and to get away, and it's not the Hamptons, and it's not Greenwich, Connecticut, and I think that...
We can only hope it stays that way.
I think it's because of the hills. I think that you just can't... You can't spread out and you know, you can tuck yourself away in the hills of the Berkshires and hide.
No, I think you're right. I was brought up in the summers on Fire Island, and then that crowd, you know, moved to Amagansett, and then they moved to, you know, the Hamptons, and then they moved to Columbia County, and now many of them are in the Berkshires. Yes?
Yeah.
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah, took a little getting used to live there for me. I like the city, and I like the pace and everything, but there's nothing like the quiet now that pervades the mornings in the Berkshires. I don't know if I could live without it.
What's next for you? We only got a minute, but what's next?
Well, we've started, because of our ability to make a little bit more of our pieces, we're wholesaling a little bit to different stores around the country. We have some of our things at Barney's in New York, and we have some things out in San Francisco at Gump's, and we're going to do a little bit more of that. We used to do that several years ago, but then we got a little bit ahead of ourselves with that. We were stretching ourselves too thin.
Yes, but if you're taking 6 months to do a single piece, obviously, and you're sending something to Gumps, do you send a single piece to Gumps or do you send...
No, we have collections, and we have... One of the things I'd like to say is that we are diverse. We make every single thing that we show in the store, and we have a range of things that are quite unusual for one single designer to have. In other words, we have engagement rings, we have men's jewelry, we have sort of fashion-y jewelry, we have important diamond jewelry, we have beads from all these different sources. And so it's not just a very narrow little look that people see when they come to us. They see what a place, like a place almost the way Tiffany's would have been 120 years ago. Mm-hmm. That's what you see. You know, we're a friendly place. People seem to think we're friendly. You didn't think we were.
No, I was a little afraid of you, but then, you know, then...
Well, I was afraid of you, too, so...
Then Roselle said, we have to go. So she grabbed me by the little hair I have left, and she pulled me in there and had a great day. And you're a remarkable man. You really are. And we've been talking today with Tim McClelland, partner and owner with Walter McTeague of McTeague and McClelland, a jeweler in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, but not just a jeweler, the jeweler. You can find out more at mc2jewels, JEWELS.com. Tim, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's nice to come and talk to you.
Listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.